And thank you, Dylan, for that reading from the book of Acts a while ago. I appreciate it very much. There's only one in all of Scripture to be called a man after God's own heart by name. And David is mentioned more than any other character in the pages of the New Testament, any other Old Testament character in the pages of the New Testament. When we first meet David in the Old Testament, we find that he was called ruddy, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. That's the only physical description we have of young David. He may have had red hair, but more likely he was reddened or bronzed by the hours he spent out in the sun and the wind. His appearance didn't seem to have set him apart from other boys. He was the youngest in the family, and when Samuel came to anoint the next king, David's father didn't even think of including David in the room until Samuel asked, "Are these all of your sons?" "Well, there's my youngest, but he's out in the field tending the sheep." David was born about 10 years after Saul became king, and the people of Israel at that time were on a long drift away from God. They were becoming disillusioned with the king that they had wanted so badly. What do you do when you got your own way and it's not working out very well? It's disillusioning. There was an insecure feeling. But God did not abandon his people. Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." 1 Samuel 13, verses 13 and 14. We get more information about David than about anybody else in the Bible. Abraham's story, for example, is told in just 14 chapters. Joseph's story is told in 14 chapters. Jacob's story is told in 11 chapters. Elijah's story is told in 10 chapters. But David's story is told in 66 chapters of the Old Testament, and that doesn't even include the 59 references to him in the New Testament. From all antiquity, the story of David is probably the greatest single narrative representation of a human life evolving by slow steps through time and being shaped and altered by the pressures of political life, public institutions, family, impulses of the body, impulses of the mind, and the eventual sad decay of the flesh. The story of David provides unflinching insight into human behavior. Nowhere else is the Bible's ability to define its characters more brilliantly deployed. And on two occasions, one in the Old Testament and one in the New, he's called a man after God's own heart, because God saw something in David that he could use, though it wasn't on the surface. Man looketh on the outward appearance, but God looketh on the heart. 1 Corinthians 1:26. "You see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. The base things of the world and the despised God hath chosen, and the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are, that no man should boast before God." God saw spirituality in David. People get terribly enamored of the surface things. People are elected to high office based on their appearance. David didn't look much different than any other boy. If we'd have been David's neighbors, we possibly might not have even known his name. He had seven older brothers. What does it mean that you are a person after God's own heart? It means that what is important to God is important to you. It means that you have a heart that's sensitive to the things of God. In 2 Chronicles 16:9, we find that the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. To be after God's heart means that when you do wrong, you admit it and you come to terms with it. You're grieved over your wrong. You're concerned about things that displease God. You care about the motivations behind your actions. A second quality that God saw in David was humility. He was faithfully keeping his father's sheep. God saw in David the heart of a servant. God didn't care about head and shoulders taller. There'd been too much of that already. He cared about character. Is he authentic or is he a fake? The purpose of the servant is to make somebody else successful. The servant does not want the person he serves to fail. God looked at David and he saw integrity. From the care of the ewes with suckling lambs, he brought him to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. Psalm 78, verses 71 and 72. Integrity is what you are when nobody's looking. The training ground of David was lonely, obscure, monotonous, and authentic. God trained David in solitude. Nature was his nurse, his companion, and his teacher. Bethlehem is 5 or 6 miles south of Jerusalem. It's 200 feet above the level of the Mediterranean Sea, with rich fields where Ruth once gleaned, and which gave the place its name, House of Bread. The moorlands around Bethlehem are wild, gaunt, strong, and character-breeding. It was there that David first imbibed the knowledge of natural scenery and pastoral pursuits, which colored all his life and poetry. Solitude has nurturing qualities. People who must have superficial sounds to survive lack depth. If you can't stand to be alone with yourself, there's something unresolved in you. Solitude has a way of helping us address those issues. When was the last time you got alone by yourself in nature and just soaked it in? So alone that the sound of silence seemed deafening. Well, that's where David lived. That's where he first learned to be king. Surely for many nights he sat alone under the stars and felt the winds of autumn and the rains of winter, and endured the summer sun. Solitude was one of his teachers. When I was a boy, you could get out into the woods like that. Today, if a young person goes out into the woods and they have their phone with them, all their friends are there. It's different. David grew up in obscurity, unknown, unseen, unappreciated, and unapplauded. Character is built in obscurity. David was trained in monotony. He was faithful in menial routine through endless hours. And it was real training. In 1 Samuel 17, David is standing beside Saul when the giant appears. Saul is scared to death and hides in his tent. And David said, "Who is this Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And Saul says, "Well, who are you? Where have you been?" "I'm David. I've been with my father's sheep." And Saul says, "Well, you can't fight this Philistine. You're just a kid." David replies without hesitation, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he arose against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him." Verses 34 and 35. David had been killing lions and bears while nobody was looking. He'd been facing that kind of reality long before he faced Goliath. It's in the little things, it's in the lonely places, that we prove ourselves capable of bigger things. Cultivate the habit of doing little things well. The conversion of a soul may happen in a moment, but the development of a saint is the task of a lifetime. You don't have to be smart to be obedient. All you have to do is obey. For David, the day that Samuel came to his house started out with a morning like any other day. Samuel looked at Eliab, David's oldest brother, and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." What Samuel didn't see was the character of Eliab. Eliab was critical and negative, as we find out later, and he looked down on his younger brother. The parade of possibles went by in Jesse's living room, and the Lord literally told Samuel, "Man looks at the face, God looks at the heart." Wouldn't it be something to see people not by face, but by heart? God saw Eliab and then Abinadab and then Shammah as they really were. David, as a teenager, walks into the house and an old man comes over and pours oil on his head. And Josephus says that Samuel whispered in David's ear, "You will be the next king." What did David do? Go shopping for crowns? No. He went back to the sheep. And later, when he was sent to play music for Saul, that's where he was, still out there with the sheep when he was called to go to the king. And David went back and forth from and to Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. We find this in 1 Samuel 17. David did not expect special treatment. He went back and did his job. And that's one reason he was a man after God's own heart. He was faithful in the little things. David had become a skilled musician. Music was used to bring him together with Saul. We saw in the class this morning that David wrote at least half of the songs, the Psalms, and they range over the whole gamut of human emotions. Whatever your mood, you can find one of the Psalms that expresses it. David went to Saul and provided soft music for a hard heart, and he got more training there. He killed Goliath and became an overnight celebrity. A lot of people couldn't take that in stride, but David did. David went wherever Saul sent him because Saul was his boss. He was loyal in submission to his king. Four times in chapter 18, we're told that David prospered and that David behaved himself wisely. He submitted to authority. Despite his youth and inexperience, David knew how to conduct himself with everybody. The servants liked him, the troops followed him, and even Saul, when he wasn't in the grip of the evil spirit, respected David. David did right without getting tired of doing right. But over time, the crutches in David's life began to fall away from beneath him. He lost the crutch of his good position. Saul started throwing spears at him, and after the second time, David never again served in Saul's army. David lost the crutch of his wife. Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David, but when David escaped Saul through subterfuge, Michal, to save herself, said, "Well, he threatened to kill me if I didn't help him get away." And never again would they live together in harmony. David fled and came to Samuel at Ramah, and he and Samuel went and stayed at Naoth, where there were condominiums in a maze-like arrangement where it made it real hard to find you. It was the type of place where a lot of people lived and they moved around. You didn't know where anybody was at any given time. Nevertheless, David was forced to flee even from Naoth, and when he did, he lost Samuel as a crutch. And David's emotional stability began to erode through all of this. He said, "There's hardly a step between me and death." And he fled to Jonathan, his best friend. But he had to leave his friend, and he loses the crutch of contact with his closest friend. Finally, David even lost his self-respect when he goes down to Achish, the king of Gath, and he's living in foreign territory, and he has to fake insanity even to survive. He lost his job, he lost his relationship with his wife, he lost his wisest counselor, he lost contact with his best friend, and he lost his self-respect. These were crutches that could have been substitutes for God. Crutches that tend to keep the focus horizontal. Crutches that offer only temporary relief. It's so easy to let the gifts that God gives us make us so that we don't really see God and to be substitutes and take the place of God. David got stripped of all the substitutes, and he goes out and lives in the cave of Adullam. And he wrote psalms about these experiences. Psalm 102, Psalm 142, Psalm 57, Psalm 34. This was all training for David, but it doesn't explain David. Abraham Lincoln is not explained by a log cabin and a hearth and a shovel that he could write math on the back of to learn with charcoal. Something else has to explain David, too. We often talk about him being a man after God's own heart, but what is the heart of God like? And how can our heart be like David's and like God's? David's really been a puzzle to me for a long time, and maybe he's been a puzzle for thousands of years. His life perplexes us. It sometimes maddens us. It humbles students of the Bible. To many, it just doesn't seem to make sense. This man who was so prone to personal weakness still had God treat him with special favor. David was many things. He was a shepherd, a psalmist, a king, and he was a liar, an adulterer, and a murderer. But he was only the one person in the entire span of the Bible to be called a man after God's own heart. And it was God who said that he was. God singled him out for that almost unfathomable compliment. But in saying those words, God threw open the door to each of us to be like David, a person after God's own heart. We all have the same opportunity to embody in our own personality the kind of heart that reflects the heart and the emotions and the personality of God. Why did David get this special distinction from God? What was it that set him apart from so many other godly people in the Bible? He wasn't any more obedient than some others. He wasn't even as obedient as some others. If we want a sterling example of obedience, we look at Daniel. There's nothing bad said about Daniel, although there's really not much said at all, just a few chapters. David was committed to obeying God's commands, and that is critically important. Jesus equated obedience with love in John 14:23. That desire chiseled and shaped the heart of David over many years, but he was far from a solid model of obedience throughout his life. There was a yawning gap between David's sincere resolve and his actual actions sometimes. What does that tell us? It tells me that there's more to being a person after God's heart than just obedience. And this is very hard for me to talk about because I don't want to even seem to be downplaying obedience. Obedience is very important. And yet, behind obedience is a motivation. Why are you being obedient? And I think when we ask that question, we get toward the heart of David. The posture of your heart before God is important. Our sincere intentions to obey are very significant to God. He notices our desires and not just our outward actions. What are you doing? Yes, but why are you doing it? We all start out in our relationship to God with an immature love. Maturity takes time. But sincere love at any maturity level is real, it's authentic in God's eyes. David's deep down determination to love and obey was valued by God. David was a student of the emotions of God. You can tell this in the Psalms. He wanted to know what wonders, what pleasures, what awesome things filled the heart of his Creator. David spent his best energies trying to understand what emotions burned in the personality of God. This was a king like no other, peering into the heart of the uncreated one. And it's this reality that fueled David's obedience, a remarkable hunger to understand the heart of God. David had a grasp of the emotions, the intentions, and the passions of God's heart. One key to being a person after God's own heart is yearning to know how God feels, how the passions of his heart move. David wrote by inspiration about what he saw in God's heart. Psalm 36, verses 7 and 8. How excellent is thy loving kindness, O God! Therefore the children of men put their trust under the shadow of thy wings. They shall be abundantly satisfied with the fatness of thy house, and thou shalt make them drink of the river of thy pleasures. And the word translated pleasures there is the word Eden, the pleasures of Eden, the river of thy Eden. God's river of passion for us drove him to be incarnated and hung on a cross. And he will not be denied a relationship with his creatures. God has chosen a group who will serve him and please him. You decide whether you'll be in that group as an individual, but God has chosen a group. And to think of God this way, I believe, supercharges our obedience. We mature more rapidly than if we plot along with a false view of a passionless God. We often go after the fullness of God's heart with an astonishing energy as we are motivated by His affections and His desires for us. I don't think it's possible to out-love and outlive the thrill of being loved and enjoyed by God. I don't think you can outgrow that thrill. It's the experience that all human beings really grope for, whether they understand what they're looking for or not. Even when things go badly for us, in our heart, that is the lamp lit by the power of God's love. We know that if all else fails, we still have the most important thing, the love of God for us. And God created us to be this way. He's the one who put these deep longings to be loved inside of us. We were designed right down to our DNA to live in a spiritual pleasure of being enjoyed by God. In David's life, prayer was not usually in the category of sacrifices I make for God. David talked to God because he wanted to. Jeremiah 9:23-24 makes this telling statement. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, let not the mighty man glory in his might, nor the rich man glory in his riches, but let him who glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord, exercising loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these I delight, saith the Lord. The Lord delights in his people. God looked at David and he said, this guy's heart is like mine. I can use him. There were other people like this too. It's just that nobody by name was said to be in this category. Jeremiah 3:15 says, I will give you shepherds according to my heart. That's pastors according to my heart, which shall feed you with knowledge and understanding. Psalm 16:11, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Whatever we understand about God's heart toward us, that's what we tend to become in our hearts toward Him. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Our hearts are not renewed primarily by staying away from bad things, but by filling our minds with the truth about God. How does God feel most of the time? Is He bored? Is He worried? Is He blasé or is He happy? Is He concerned? Is He detached? Is He engaged? Is He mad? Is He sad? Is He glad? And more importantly, how does God feel when He looks at you? What wells up in the heart of God when He turns His eyes toward your life? I find that people usually respond to that in one of two ways. When God looks at me, He's mostly mad. Or when God looks at me, He's mostly sad. But consider Deuteronomy 30, verse 9. In the Lord thy God, the Lord thy God will make thee plenteous. He's talking to the people of God. He will make thee plenteous in every work of thine hand, in the fruit of thy body and in the fruit of thy cattle, in the fruit of thy land for good. For the Lord will again rejoice over thee for good as He rejoiced over thy fathers. What? As He rejoiced over our fathers? Wait a minute. The fathers of these people are the ones who were the murmurers. The fathers were the recalcitrant mutineers who exasperated Moses all the time. And yet, God is said to have rejoiced over those people. In parts of Exodus and Numbers, it's hard to remember that God rejoiced over those fathers. And yet, that's the overarching theme, that God rejoices in His people. Proverbs 3:12, whom the Lord loves, He corrects, just as a father, the son in whom He delights. The primary emotion there is delight. We correct because of the caring love and delight. Zephaniah 3:17. He will take great delight in you. He will quiet you with His love. He will rejoice over you with singing. God created us for His pleasure. Revelation 4:11. And God experiences that pleasure. God is smiling at you as you respond to Him in willing obedience. Psalm 149, verse 4, God takes pleasure in His people. He will beautify the humble with salvation. Proverbs 8:31. He rejoices in the inhabited world and delights in the sons of men. The prodigal son was confused by his father's overwhelming delight, but it was there. He was all ready to say, could I possibly be one of your hired servants? But he's accepted back as a son because the father was delighted with him. 1 Chronicles 16:27. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and gladness are in his place. Joy prevails everywhere in heaven. The God we love overflows with gladness. And this is not sporadic. It's a lifestyle. Joy is a lifestyle in heaven. Whoever gets close to God's throne in heaven seems to have exquisite joy. Smiling in heaven is not required. It's just inevitable. Joy is the province of people who chose of their own free will to enter into it. We will see someone who makes us extraordinarily glad. There is a combination of overwhelming terror of God's majesty and an overflowing happiness. It's too much, and yet we want more. It's so intense, it's too much, but yet it's never enough. The gladness of God is foundational to helping our hearts grow into spiritual maturity. Nehemiah 8, verse 10. The joy of the Lord is our strength. God lays out the only two options that exist. In Deuteronomy 28, 47 and 48, he says, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness of heart for the abundance of everything, therefore you shall serve your enemies. But God's not acting out of spite when he says that. God's not pouting and saying, well, you wouldn't enter into my gladness, so just forget it. Now you're going to have to serve your enemies. He's just talking about the natural consequences of not obeying him. We either enter into his gladness with our whole hearts, or we will come under the influence of the enemy, because that's the way life is constructed. As the dominoes fall, we end up serving the lies of the enemy instead of living beneath the truths of God, because we begin to see God as different from what he is. That's what the devil in the Garden of Eden persuaded Eve of. God is different than you think he is. We imbibe false notions about God. The second psalm said, kiss the son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. If we don't kiss the son, meaning entering into relationship with him, we will eventually fall prey to an accusing spirit against God because of his judgments. This is the enemy's tactic. He tries to align us with himself and bring us into opposition to the Lord by unleashing accusations against God. He's been doing that since Genesis 3. If we accept the enemy's logic, then it brings God's wrath upon us. But a tight connection with God is the only divine plan for avoiding this. God doesn't give us the option of living in a gray zone somewhere. You're either lovesick for him and glad before him, or you're not. There's no middle ground. You're either David dancing before the Lord with all your might, or you're Michael criticizing and despising David because she doesn't love God that much and she doesn't know what it's all about. Hidden within our hearts are not just shameful things, but a lot of good things, like the cry to be totally God's. Deep inside, we fight to be fully his. We fight to stand against all oppositions of the enemy. And only God fully perceives the depth of this longing in our heart. The yes in our spirit is an imperfect yes, but it's still a yes. God is pleased with your longings to be fully his. That's the essence of the real you. That's the best you. God smiles on us and enjoys us, though we are yet spiritually immature. And he encourages us then to go on unto perfection, to be mature. If his gladness were based on performance, we would be a sad lot. But the Lord corrects us as a father, a son in whom he delights. We are his present delight. That's why he corrects us. He's not waiting for you to achieve some level of maturity before he delights in you. He delights in you when you're immature, but he wants you to improve. Psalm 60, verse 6. God has spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. The gladness and holiness in God's heart are not opposed to one another. God's gladness is an expression of his holiness. It's a holy gladness, and it encourages a joyous holiness on our part. Jesus, in spite of the sorrow, the suffering through which he went, lived a joyous life here on earth. God anointed him with the oil of gladness above his fellows, Hebrews 1, 8 and 9. The prophecy in Psalm 16 makes clear, therefore did my heart rejoice and my tongue was glad. Moreover, also my flesh shall rest in hope, because thou wilt not leave my soul in Hades, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. You make me full of joy in your presence. Acts 2, verses 25 through 28. Peter said it on the day of Pentecost, that Jesus had a rejoicing heart. He had a glad tongue. He was full of joy. David was speaking of himself when he penned that psalm. But by inspiration, Peter applied it to Jesus, the Son of David. Jesus said, he that hath seen me hath seen the Father. Jesus is the brightness of God's glory. He's the express image of God's person. We know what the Father's heart is when we see the heart of Jesus. Of course, Jesus knew anger and grief and sorrow according to circumstance, but he lived a life of placidity, a life of tranquility, and genuine gladness was his dominant emotion. The heart of David. You can contrast that with King Saul. When the Lord's prophet confronted King Saul, he always had an excuse. Well, I thought this, or it was somebody else's fault. But when the Lord's prophet confronted King David with a little story and then said, thou art the man, David dissolved into repentant contrition and obedience. 3 of the 30 chief men came to David in the cave of Adullam. And David said with longing, oh, that somebody would give me a drink from the well of water that's at Bethlehem, which is by the gate. And when they brought that water to David, having risked their lives to get it, David said, is this not the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives? He told those men, your children could have been orphaned. Your wives could have been widowed. You could have lost everything to get me this water. So David then poured it out in sacrifice to the Lord. Over and over again, we see these kinds of reactions from David. I will not give the Lord that which cost me nothing. David never did worship images made by man. He said, rather, I esteem all your precepts, God, concerning all things to be right, and therefore I hate every false way. Oh, how love I thy law. It is my meditation all the day. In his law doth he meditate day and night. We could talk about the 10 worst sins of David, and when we were done, none of us would like him very much. But primarily, David was a man of one thing, just as Mary of Bethany was a woman of one thing. Both of them knew the secret of a focused life, of giving themselves to one thing. Just as Paul said, this one thing I do. Mary of Bethany had nothing to set her apart from many other followers of Jesus except a heart of devotion. She's in Scripture 3 times, and each time she's sitting at the feet of Jesus in the book of Luke and in the book of John. She was always there when Jesus was around, listening to him and pouring out her love to him. She was more than just a groupie who hangs around for the thrill of being near a celebrity. She was one who understood the Lord. So she let other responsibilities go and prized every minute of the Lord's presence. And yes, she was criticized for it. Every time she appears in the Bible, she's bearing the brunt of somebody's harsh words. And she's never described as giving an answer to defend herself, because she was living in front of an audience of one. The Lord said, one thing is needful, and Mary hath chosen that good part, and it shall not be taken away from her. Love the Lord your God first, and then your neighbor as yourself. If you try to reverse the order of those, your joy will leak out like a flat tire. The first commandment must be first, and the second commandment must be second. And when we get that first commandment in its first place, then the second will naturally flow from it. And all the power of hell will fight to keep you from being a people of one thing. But if you accomplish the goal of being such a person, then your joy will be full. We're going to extend the Lord's invitation, as is our custom. And if you can come to one of the front chairs to tell us what your needs are, we'll stand and sing an invitation number while you do that. Denny, go ahead. Softly and tenderly.